This is Main Street on Pray Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we are in the final hours, I guess, of the 63rd legislative session, which is still underway in Bismarck, the longest session in modern history in North Dakota. And I guess that's because there's so much to decide about so much money. At any rate, we're going to talk about that because it's time for our editor's roundtable. We do this once a month. Dave Thompson, Pray Public News Director, joins us from our studio in Bismarck. Hiya, Dave.
How you doing, Doug?
Real well. I hope you're holding up. Mike Jacobs is with us from our Grand Forks studio. Mike is the Grand Forks Herald publisher. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
You bet. Thank you.
And Tom Gerhardt, also in Bismarck, KXMB-TV news director. Thank you, Tom, for coming in today.
Good afternoon.
Well, let's jump right into what happened overnight and again this morning. Dave, tie up that little story so far.
Tying up the story is going to be interesting because the legislature is still meeting.
Yeah.
In terms of tying up what we can do, what we can tell you right now is that House Bill 1319, which was the education funding bill and was the governor's preferred method for having property tax relief, well, they passed it last night in the House, passed it barely, 49-41, and this morning they reconsidered it, and it failed on a tie vote to 46-46. Well, that caused some major consternation. That was a very interesting debate. It went well over an hour and was very emotional. And just listening to it, there were some very, very heated exchanges about that bill. Right now, that bill is still dead. Now, when I say it's still dead, who knows? It's a legislative session. You never say never until the gavel falls.
Well, Mike, you and I were talking just briefly before we went on the air about all the reconsidered stuff this session, and this is just more of that.
It's been truly extraordinary. I don't immediately recall a time when there's been less clarity about what the direction of the legislation was going to be. Normally, with a week or 10 days, even sometimes a fortnight left to go, there's a pretty good structure in place to attach the legislation to. But there's no evidence of that in this session whatever. There's very little evidence that the two houses have been able to work together.
Yeah.
Somebody was joking that there are two parties in North Dakota, the House and the Senate. And confusion, I guess, is that there's a substantial Republican majority in both houses. There's a Republican in the governor's office, but they've not been able to agree on anything that is truly state policy. I mean, they did have some distractions early in the session where they made the national news, but those are really not state policies. That's abortion rights are a social issue nationally. It's been really quite extraordinary. My solution to the problem is to amend the Constitution to require that no party can have more than 60% majorities, so that they have a focus to hate rather than falling upon one another.
Well, they certainly have been doing that. Tom, what's your take on what you've seen in the last couple of days?
Well, I think what's interesting about today is, and it's been mentioned, that this is Governor Dalrymple's plan, and there's been a lot of blood, sweat, and tears shed over formulating this plan, trying to come up with something that would work. And as Mike mentioned, I mean, with a majority in both chambers, one would suspect that you would have support. I don't know how the governor feels right now. I suppose he's not very happy with the way things went this morning. But as far as the session as a whole, I think Mike was correct as well. It's kind of been like a game of whack-a-mole. You don't know what's going to pop up next or where. So I think there were distractions that I think many North Dakotans paying attention would think that the priorities were perhaps out of order.
And this is just an odd little thing to throw in there. Mike, you mentioned that it's two Republican parties, the House Republicans and Senate Republicans. You have the Democrats supporting Dalrymple, which I think is extremely interesting.
Well,
it's an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, it goes to Jack Dalrymple's governing style And I think there's some resentment of it among what I think of as populist Republicans, not Tea Party people per se, but Republicans who really believe that that the people should have their fingers in all of this. Jack Dalrymple is the sort of the consummate broker in the back. You know, he likes the details of legislation. He's not particularly open about drawing a whole bunch of people in. He'd prefer to bring in the experts and then present a plan. And I think that we're seeing, to some extent, a rejection of that leadership style, that governing style. I shouldn't call it a leadership style, a governing style, in a very dramatic way. I mean, they basically poured swamp water in a champagne bowl.
Well, and again, I saw today House Majority Leader Al Carlson stand up and excoriate the Senate.
Oh, yeah, that was very interesting. and he came a little close about saying something he should not have on the floor.
But,
you know, he you can hear the frustration in his voice because he thinks that the House has given too much.
But by contrast with the governor, Al Carlson has no governing style. You know, he's sort of a basketball without a player behind it. He just sort of, you know, ricochets across the gymnasium, and he's really not been able to exact any kind of rigor or discipline out of his majority caucus. And in fact, it has occurred to me that that he really doesn't have any kind of policy objective in mind, other than sort of being a bomb thrower, for lack of a better term. I don't mean to libel the man in that way, but you know, just, you know, somebody who's there more to make trouble than to actually bring forward a cohesive legislative program.
And they're running out of time. Article 4, Section 7 of the North Dakota Constitution limits regular sessions to 80 natural days during a biennium, and they define a natural day as a period of 24 consecutive hours. House and Senate Rules 104 provide that a legislative day begins at 7 a.m., so each legislative day ends at 7 a.m. the following day. So we've got Saturday morning yet, I guess, ahead of us.
Now let's talk about this, because there was a lot of discussion on the floor today about what happens if. And there are some members of both houses who believe that if the gavel does not fall at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, that the legislative day continues.
All right, so it can be a 36-hour day.
There are others that believe they can't do that because the rules say 7 a.m. to 7 a.m., but again, there are legislative rules, and you can suspend the rules, and we've had people who have suspended the rules. Go ahead.
I don't want any of you to think that I'm really, really old, but in 1965... The legislature covered the clock.
Ah, now that's something they do in Minnesota.
I was going to say Minnesota can do that still.
Now, but let us mark well what happened in the 1966 election. The majority, the 1965 was one of the few years in North Dakota history when Democrats were pretty well fully in charge, and they were drubbed at the polls in 1966 following the embarrassment of a failed legislative session.
Well, we'll see whether or not...
I shouldn't say a failed legislative session. Actually, a lot of legislation was passed that session, but not much of it was popular.
Well, now let's actually delve into the bills that failed and were forwarded. And they deal with K-12 funding. That one went down in flames, and that was literally the governor's plan to more than double the state's contribution to per-pupil funding. And now it's basically back to a property tax package that's going to the Senate. What does this really mean to North Dakota property taxpayers?
Well, I don't think we know for sure what that does mean. But the figure everybody is talking about is $1 billion full tax relief package. Now, about $750 million of that would be in property taxes, and $250 million as passed by both houses, would be in income taxes and corporate taxes. The $750 million, I think the figure is pretty much agreed on. That's what people want. But how do you deliver it? Do you deliver it through a mill levy buy down, which is what they've been doing for the past couple of bienniums, or do you deliver it in terms of you give the money to schools and say you will reduce your mill levy by this amount? So that's the real hang up, I think.
Yeah, but the far more important question is the important question is not so much what does this mean to taxpayers, it's what does it mean to public education in the state.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. My sense is that North Dakota legislature believes that children must be protected until they are born, and at the moment of birth they're on their own.
Well, this number that they're talking about, $750 million, is $100 million less than the annual total property tax gathered in the state. And the devil is in the details. As Dave was saying, there are two different ways that they're looking at applying this relief. The problem they've had with the mill levy buy-downs is that the assessments keep going up.
Yes, and that's what you heard on the floor, is a lot of people talking about. What can you do about assessments? That is a kind of, I think, the $750 million question. What can you do in terms of trying to hold the assessments down? Do you say assessments can't raise above 2-3% every year, or how do you do that? Because property values are very important when you're talking about trading, selling, and taxing property.
Well, and property values are going up sharply all over the state, right?
Yes. I mean, the big drop that happened around 2010 for the previous session dropping property taxes has pretty much been leveled out now by the increase in assessed value. But to what Mike was saying, the state currently spends a little shy of $4,000 per student. The bill that the governor was in support of, that 1319, that House bill that went down, would have bumped that to $8,810 per student, more than doubled it. So that would have been a significant investment in K-12 education.
Well, you wonder, too, how much the public is paying attention to all of this, going back to Measure 2 last summer, which fell, and all the pressure around that this summer and fall when they were crafting bills for the session, as many as 16 to 20, perhaps, were on the table at one time. And now here we are into the last moments trying to deliver property tax relief to people, which with the rising increase in values of properties, some people probably don't even necessarily feel each year, because it kind of levels it off. Perhaps if they had a 6 to 8 year span to see how much things have changed. But I don't know if this is about who takes credit or about what's best for the people. But here we do have kids and our future at stake. And as Mike stated, the quality of education and what can be delivered to our children.
Now I'm going to throw a little bit more controversy into this, or how complex it is. 1312 was a policy bill. There's actually no money, no dollar figure in it. That's in the DPI budget, which is still pending. They haven't voted on the DPI budget to come to a final agreement on that. So when we say 1312 is dead, well, with conference committees meeting and with that OMB bill out there, the OMB bill, the catch-all, you throw everything, including the kitchen sink that you couldn't get passed earlier in the session, goes into the OMB bill. There are still some avenues to do this, but if you do it, then there's a mechanical problem about getting the session done.
Yeah,
and
right.
That's about, getting the right wording in the right places for the bill.
Well, I have my own. You probably noticed that I'm feeling a little cantankerous today.
No, not at all.
I don't think that the echo from this legislative session is going to be about who gets credit. It's going to be about where to place blame.
Yeah.
Because during the campaign on the property tax measure, the public was promised that this would be dealt with in the legislature, and the public voters took political leaders at their word and defeated what the political establishment was saying, and what I also believe would have been a ruinous property tax reform measure. But actually, it was a property tax elimination measure.
Mm-hmm.
But now we have the situation where those who promised, they said, don't eliminate the property tax, we'll fix the problem. And now we have, a very short amount of time to make that happen.
That's Mike Jacobs, Grand Forks Herald publisher. He's with Dave Thompson, Prairie Public News Director, and Tom Gerhardt, KXMB-TV News Director. We're talking with our Editor's Roundtable, our monthly chat about what's in the news, and the legislature is in the news. More on this in a moment.
It's a night of jazz on Prairie Public. Following the rebroadcast of Main Street, we kick it off with Friday Night Swing with Lloyd Anderson. Then at 9 Central, it's Riverwalk Jazz. And at 10, Bob Studebaker hosts as we present both classic jazz from the legends of American music and new jazz from emerging artists. At 11, it's the Jazz Junket with Ryan Switzer, followed at midnight by Jim Wilkie's Jazz After Hours. That's all right here, statewide, on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The music in the background is Wayne Raglan with Total Eclipse. We're talking the legislature. The 63rd session of the North Dakota legislature is trying to wind down. We're going to change the subject now to higher education. What's in play there, Dave?
Well, supposedly they're going to be voting on that yet this afternoon. Now, the Senate's going to take a look at it first. It is a Senate bill. Then I will go to the House, and they've gone through a conference committee. I took a look at the Senate amendments before it was supposed to come to the floor, and do you remember the Tony Grinberg amendment, Senator Grinberg from Fargo?
Yes.
He had put the amendment in saying that he's going to set aside some money to buy out the chancellor. Well, that's been removed, and they've softened the language a little bit. Not to say that there might not be money in there to do that, should they decide to do that, but that's one thing that is out of the bill. At least in terms of specific language. Also, there's another bill which concerns the funding formula for higher education. That also was backed by the governor and was created by some of the finance officers at the college system, the university system. That's still at play, and there is some uneasiness about that formula in the House. I will be honest with you. That's what you're hearing. And you're hearing a lot of people saying, we don't know if that formula can pass.
So, another example of the governing style.
Mm-hmm.
Well, expand on that, Mike.
Well, this is a piece of legislation that has been brought forward by experts and not by legislators themselves.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
Dave, what's the status of the buildings? Not that I have any parochial interest.
Yes. The buildings are no longer delineated in there. They've come up with this idea of a pool concept.
So it's now a pool.
It's now a pool.
Does that put it in the higher ed board's purview then?
Yes,
they make
it does.
The decisions?
They will make the decisions. Now, this whole thing has been just an interesting, I'd say a maze to watch this thing go through, because you have at the time where the measure is also pending about creating a 3-member professional board of higher education, if you want to call it that, or a department of higher education run by 3 professionals.
Where is that?
That's going to be voted on, too.
That's a very interesting bill because, I've been asking, when I was there on Monday, I was asking Tony Grinberg, senator from Fargo, and also Max Schneider, senator from Grand Forks, the issue of this kind of governance form in terms of accreditation, whether or not there would be any, issues with that. And there was a difference of opinion. Tony Grinberg didn't see a problem, and Max Schneider did.
Big surprise there.
Yeah. Imagine that. Well, how is Ham Shirvani doing these days?
That is a very good question. He has been keeping a fairly low profile the past couple of weeks. And, of course, we have some of the newspaper editorialists who have called for him to step down, as well as the president of the Board of Higher Education, hint, hint, for him.
Yeah, I would say not some of the editorialists. I would say that was an editorial that was directed from the corporate office.
Sure, sure. Now, do you want to tell us what you think of it?
Well, I the Herald in general has been the most supportive of the state's daily newspapers of the current higher education structure,
mm-hmm.
not the specific personalities involved. But I think we face a kind of catastrophe if the constitutional amendment is advanced to the ballot and the chancellor is forced out, because how on earth are you going to find someone who would take that job in that kind of an atmosphere?
I think it was challenging to get Hampshire Bonnie here.
It was. And so what the likely outcome would be is that you have a caretaker chancellor, probably somebody picked because of his or her political connections, which is exactly why we created the Board of Higher Education mm-hmm. in the first place, was to avoid all of that.
Try to divorce politics from it. Right.
I think we're in very dangerous territory. Notwithstanding the opinion of the ownership of the company that I work for.
Okay. Well, I just had to ask, and I anticipated what you were going to say, Mike, because I have been reading a lot of the editorials in the daily newspapers about what the editorialists are thinking about the whole system of higher education, the controversy that seems to continue to swirl around it, and with a legislative session going on, and there are legislators in that chamber who did not like the idea of the round table several years ago, and they thought they gave up too much control. They want some more control. So there's all sorts of things at play. This is kind of fascinating to watch.
Well, it's riveting.
Yes, it is.
I just thought how interesting too, just to watch a little bit from afar, but yet closely here in the capital city. Mr. Shirvani came in and was charged with this job to carry out a plan, and he introduced one very quickly late last July, early August. And, I don't know if he's difficult to work with or for, but, saying to Dave, it seems like, he's probably blamed for the 20 inches of snow Bismarck had, too. Yeah. It seems like, they keep trying to find a smoking gun to bring him down. And, it's just another case, too, where it seemed like lawmakers were kind of focusing on the wrong thing again.
Yeah. I cannot resist pointing out that the front page story that ran in the Herald and the Forum on Sunday, the same day as the editorial calling for the resignation, that story was about the chain of emails that has been exchanged.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it revealed an array of college and university presidents who are loath to take direction. And some of them emerged, I must say, as pretty petty about the whole thing. And so, in a way, the story proved what critics of the Board of Higher Education have been saying, which is that the chancellor's office has not been strong enough. There's been too much parochial interest campus by campus. And then the next day or 2 days later, we have the resignation of the systems information officer. I'm sorry, the systems auditor, who says he can't do the job. There's work enough for six people, which is pretty close to the number that the governor asked for, in the higher education office.
And all that happens as the attorney general is saying, you had illegal meetings.
Well, but that's unforgivable. I mean, that's the place where what I would say in the Herald editorial office is tepid support for the chancellor. We're not prepared to tolerate this kind of law breaking. And again, the people who are really responsible for this are the Board of Higher Education, the members of the Board of Higher Education, who know very well that they are required to hold open meetings, to post notice of meetings, and all of that.
All right. We're going to take a break for news. We're talking with Mike Jacobs, Grand Forks Herald publisher, Dave Thompson, Prairie Public News Director, and Tom Gerhardt, KXNB-TV News Director. Now the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. So far, so good, and that's a surprise. That's from Nietzsche Mayor Lee Beatty, who says this flood is much different than past ones and is much better. Beatty's not sure what's going on.
Previous years at these levels, river levels, past 21 feet, we've had quite a bit of overland, and it's threatened Highway 18, if not gone over, and so far there's been none of that. The river's kind of been being a good boy this year and staying in its banks, and even though they're at some pretty high levels, which is fine. We'll take that.
Beattie says the predictions that the Pembina River will recede a little bit.
Now, we're going to drop to like 18 feet by probably Friday and hang there for 3-4 days before we start creeping back up. So if it follows the hydrograph, then we're feeling pretty good.
Beattie says the floodwater staying within the banks means no pressure on the community ring dike. He's not sure why this is happening, but perhaps the recent floods have carved out more space in the Pembina River so it's able to accommodate more water. Farmers in the Red River Valley are looking to get their spring work started thanks to the fact flooding in the valley was not as widespread as originally predicted. Paul Rutherford is vice president of the Red River Sugar Beet Growers Association and says he's encouraged.
I think we'll get the sugar beets and the rest of the crops in the ground. Matter of fact, I'm looking at probably early next week to get started, and I'm east of East Grand Forks. So I heard there was a planter rolling by Ada, or a grain drill, and there was also a planter, row crop planter, rolling over in the Sabin area. So things are starting to shape up.
Rutherford says while a lot of the snowmelt was able to be absorbed during the extended thaw, the soil profile has not been fully recharged. He says growers will have to rely on some million-dollar rains this season.
I think from about Oslo north in the valley, they're probably pretty good shape on subsoil. From there south, my area, we're going to need, at least $2 million rains. I've got a friend that sets poles for Otter Tail Power Company, and he said 14 inches and down, it's dry as a bone. And he's out of the Crookston area.
Officials with the North Dakota Extension Service say while the planting is getting a late start, there is still some time to get the work done, but some seasonal warmth could help boost activity. And the Great Plains Food Bank has received a donation of 36,000 farm fresh eggs. Ammon Bayer runs J&A Farms out of Lake Park, Minnesota, and has been donating eggs to the food bank for the past 6 years. He says it takes a couple of hours to pack up all the eggs to transport them to the food bank. Bayer says the eggs are worth about $1.35 a dozen. He says he feels blessed to be able to offer his help.
We appreciate, we have a lot of good customers up in this northern Minnesota region, and we've been very blessed through the years in being able to run successful farming operations, and we just feel it's important for us to give some back to the community and those less fortunate.
Marsha Paulson is with the Great Plains Food Bank and says eggs are not typically donated since they are a perishable food item, but she says they are much needed to help hungry North Dakotans.
To be able to have a product that is high in nutrition, good for you, top of the list as far as what's needed, available right here from our local producers, it's a great partnership.
Paulson says by the end of next week, all the donated eggs will have been distributed to food pantries across the state. Last year, the Great Plains Food Bank distributed nearly 9.5 million meals to 75,000 people struggling with hunger. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public, and it is Editor's Roundtable Day. Once a month, we get together with some highly placed news professionals to talk about what's been in the news, and the legislature has been consuming our attention this week. Dave Thompson is with us from Bismarck, and Mike Jacobs from Grand Forks, and Tom Gerhardt, also from Bismarck. Let's move to the oil patch.
I must give you a little breaking news that the Senate did pass the new formula bill on a vote of 40-3. That happened in the 3 o'clock Central Time session. So right now, they are debating, as we are speaking to you now, they are debating the full higher education bill. So Senator Holmberg is up, and he's presenting that.
Okay. There you go, Mike.
Up to the minute.
Okay. Let's talk about oil patch infrastructure. That was a hotly debated issue as well, and it looks like a pretty big victory for Bob Scarpol.
Yes, it is not quite what he wanted, though. If you've read his comments, he says, you know, they're on their way to it, but it's not exactly what he wanted. But then again, given all the budget things that are going on, it's probably the best he could have hoped for. But it does mean a $1.1 billion infusion of cash into the oil patch.
And that's more than the governor was asking for, isn't it?
That's correct.
That's correct, yeah. And you sensed listening to lawmakers yesterday, maybe some relief, Dave. I mean, like you said, perhaps more is needed or more is wanted, but there seemed to be a lot of happy folks after some tense moments this session.
Absolutely. And then, yeah, as they're saying, it's a work in progress. And you can understand that as the oil patch continues to develop. And, of course, we've got the new figures from the USGS, which shows double the amount of possible recoverable oil from the Bakken and Three Forks.
Yeah, the double to triple.
Yeah.
And in talking to Senator Hoeven and folks in oil and gas here in Bismarck this week, and some folks in the industry, everyone seems to agree that those are all low numbers, that
yep.
this is just scratching the surface. And, of course, technology continues to improve the way that we acquire the oil. And then another story that I had done out here recently is, you know, the perimeter of the Bakken and the Three Forks is basically defined. And that happened last year, but nobody knows how deep they can go yet. Mm-hmm. And Continental had a well come off of confidential status in March that was down in the third bench of the Three Forks, which, if you could imagine, maybe an Oreo cookie being the Bakken, and then several layers below the Bakken, a third layer, if you will. Continental had a well that did really well, and they think could mean even bigger things. So I think the bigger question, somebody said, is maybe not how much oil is recoverable, but how much is actually down there.
There, exactly.
And then, you know, so, if you improve one percentage point on being able to recover that, it's going to be significant for the state in positive and negative ways.
How deep did that Continental well go?
It was a four-mile well. It was down, you know, 21,000, you know, horizontal and vertical. It's northwest of Watford City, that particular well. It's a Charlotte 222. And, you know, Continental now this year, from what I understand in talking to Lynn Helms here, has plans to do several more into that third bench. And, of course, it's got the industry taking notice that they're able to go down, you know, that deep, and with their fracking technologies and recipes of the proppants, I think, from China they've brought in that are firmer or bigger, that they're being, he said, it performed as well as a regular Bakken well, and it has a lot of people excited.
Well, those USGS numbers that came out earlier this week were, as you mentioned, double what the previous estimate had been of recoverable oil. And as Tom mentioned, the technology keeps changing that, I mean, because you can recover more. But the North Dakota Department of Mineral Resources has a much higher estimate, and Harold Hamm's Continental Petroleum has the highest yet. They're looking at almost 10 times what the initial USGS estimate was. So it's anybody's guess, but the people with the deepest well and the deepest pocket seem to be thinking it's a lot.
They said it's kind of like driving a new car off the lot. The minute you're off the lot, you know, its value goes down. And in the sense with the oil, they say the minute they release the report, or perhaps even before, it's an old estimate. You
right.
know, this didn't include, I believe, the success of that third bench well. But at some point, they have to draw a line and release a new estimate. So I think, you know, last time, and this is a big point between the first USGS estimate and the second one, is the first estimate did not include the Three Forks formation, and which is below the Bakken. This one did, and I asked, you know, is there more recoverable oil in the Bakken formation? That really wasn't included in this new estimate, but everybody seems to suggest that the answer to that is, of course, yes. So you can see, you know, there's a lot more oil, a recoverable oil, than even these latest numbers would suggest.
And that oil is such an important economic generator for the state. When you look at the revenue projections for the state of North Dakota historically, they just start going straight up after 2009. And it's quite incredible, the amount of wealth that has come into the state and the way the United States energy policy has sort of been transformed by this development.
It really has. If you think about, it wasn't that long ago we were talking about importing 50% or more of our oil from overseas. That's cut down quite a bit now. I think it's, is it low 40s?
Yeah,
or maybe upper 30s
I think
now?
They said this week 40%, the 40%. Lowest since 1988, I believe.
So you're seeing that the new shale plays, Bakken and the Eagle Ford in Texas, and the potential one in California, although just a sidebar, talking to Lynn Helms about that, he was invited to go to California to talk about shale plays. He came back and he said, well, I don't think so, because California has so many rules compared to what we have.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously be following it.
The conclusion about all this has to be that we're rich.
Yeah.
And are probably going to be rich. And it's a lost opportunity. The legislative session is a lost opportunity. It's time for us to begin imagining what kind of state we can have here, what sort of investments we can make that will improve the quality of life, not just for North Dakotans of this generation, but potentially this play is going to go on for, you know, I was listening to Jerry Grenwald on Minnesota Public Radio this morning.
Okay.
we'll can deal with
this
it.
Time, yes.
Well, they have good talk in the morning, you know. And Jerry Grenwald was on, and he made the point that there may be a century of oil play here. So we're not talking about our children or our grandchildren or our great-grandchildren. We're talking about what we can leave for our great-great-grandchildren. And you know, we need to begin to think, we need to get over this horrible fear we have that it's going to go away, and begin to think about how we can make sure that the economy grows in a way that will transform the place into a stable, thriving, vibrant economy over the long haul, in the way that Texas did when it struck it rich with oil.
Well, let's move to this end of the state for a moment and talk about an important project that the legislature's been dealing with, too, and that's the diversion around Fargo-Moorhead. The Red came up again this year. It's been kind of a non-event in terms of a flood, but it reminds us that we're in a very flat place that floods very easily. So what should we learn from what the legislature did this session?
Good question. I think that when it comes down to it, there may be a legislator from Fargo who may have perhaps damaged his political capital with some interests in Fargo.
And that would be the House Majority Leader.
That would be the House Majority Leader, because he introduced the amendment to prohibit any money from being spent on the diversion project until the federal government writes the check for the full amount that they're going to put into it. And the language was softened, and there has to be some financial commitment from the federal government for them to start accessing the state money to work on the diversion project. Representative Carlson has said, yes, it's softer language, but this is what he wanted to accomplish somewhat. He wanted to make sure that the federal government's feet is put to the fire, but the way things have kind of unraveled in the session, there were a lot of people in Fargo who are diversion supporters who were saying, wait a second, what are you trying to do to us? And you heard that a lot. You heard that in the subsequent hearings when they talked about the amendment in the Senate. You heard that with some of the lobbying efforts that were going on during conference committees. It's really interesting because you've got a lot of things at play there. You've got the upstream people, which are actually south of Fargo-Moorhead, as you remember, the Red flows north. So there's a lot of downstream people or upstream people who are not happy. And there were some downstream people who were not happy either with the idea of this diversion, which could cause some flooding of farmland and some flooding of cities. And how do you have to buy out some properties? And do ring dikes really work? There's all sorts of things that are still in play at this, I think.
And it's a very long-term project. It's probably 10 years or so.
Not the least of the things that's in play is that the new United States senator is from upstream of Fargo.
That's correct.
That's right.
That is correct.
Okay. Let's talk a bit about the actions of this current session that may come back to haunt lawmakers. Now, we've talked about a couple of things that have sort of come up in the conversation, but let's just go around the horn. Tom, is there anything in particular that you think might be a reverberating issue that may make a difference at the polls sometime in the future?
Well, I think, you know, we have touched on some important ones, and I think of, you know, the education funding, as Mike had said right away, taking money off the table. You know, what is the long-term vision for this state? We have the Vision 2020, but this oil suggests, as Mike said, and as Lynn Helms will say, these new numbers could expand the play by decades. It could be 100 years. So with that in mind, then zooming in a little bit, what can we do that's special, that is lasting, that will, you know, help the young people in our state. So I think, you know, education is certainly one thing. You know, what will the history books say about this session 50 years from now? You know, that'll be quite interesting. The other thing, you know, the water is a significant thing. I mean, these missed opportunities, as you said, in the Red River, that's a big project. It's going to take some time, and the longer you push it off, the more expensive it's going to get. The flooding has happened, what, 3 out of 4 times. It was a near miss this year. I mean, you know, higher education, getting back to education, and sort of the pull, the tug of war of power between the lawmakers and the board and things. So I think it could reverberate. It could be that, you know, pebble that ripples in the water in many ways that maybe will be easier to see as we get a little bit of distance from it. But those are three things that come to mind.
Mike, anything you see that is going to be a little daunting for legislators to deal with?
Well, I think that the Democrats' statement after the failure of the property tax bill this morning pretty much outlines what their campaign is going to be. It's going to be there's been a failure of leadership, and the immediate evidence of the failure of leadership is the failure to pass meaningful property tax reform. And that you're going to hear that over and over and over again. And there, you know, I think that there's going to be a subtext about the distractions of the abortion legislation early in the session. There's going to be a subtext about the sort of clumsy handling of higher education. But the central issue is going to be leadership and property tax.
Dave, what's your take?
I would agree with Mike in this. And in terms of the abortion bills, we haven't talked too much about that. But, you know, with the state possibly going to be involved in lawsuits with referrals that are out there and they're going to be on the ballot next fall, and what consequences will that have in terms of the election and how people feel about the issue, and how can you motivate your side, your base, to get to the polls? And that's being very crass politically, but that's what I see as potentially could be a downside on that. In terms of how much money the abortion lawsuits could cost the state of North Dakota, well, we know there's going to be a cost. But I was hearing some lawmakers say, oh, don't worry, we've got these outside groups that are going to help, and they're going to donate toward the cause. And I don't know if the state can accept a donation from an outside cause to fight a lawsuit defending a state law.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's allowed. And I may be wrong on that, Mike, but that's my take on that.
Yeah, I don't know about that. You know, they can obviously put up lots of amicus briefs. But
right. I was very crass, and I know any lawyers who are listening are going to be mad at me for saying this. But at a forum, when I was asked that, I said, "Yeah, there will be amicus briefs." It's kind of like kissing your sister.
Okay. Well, let's talk about somebody who left North Dakota for good this past week, and that was Bill Guy. He was remembered fondly at a couple of memorial services yesterday. And, let's talk a bit about the legacy that he left.
Well, he is the man who is responsible for what North Dakota is. I think he was governor at a critical time in the state's history, good years, and he provided the kind of leadership that made lasting economic a change happen in North Dakota. Not everybody agreed with it, but you know the initial oil, the initial coal development is his legacy. The rural electric cooperatives are at least to a degree his legacy, and the interstate highways, importantly, are his legacy. You know, he saw a role for government in the economy, and he was able through very focused and almost single-minded pushing of these things to make real economic change happen in North Dakota.
And he obviously appealed to voters. They elected him 4 times.
Yeah.
12 years.
He 12 years.
He also established the Office of Management and Budget, and my goodness, that's been important lately.
Yes, remember, it used to be called Accounting Purchases.
It did.
Yes.
And the Rough Rider Award he brought to the table.
The Rough Rider Award.
And Lawrence Welk, we hear, was the first.
He was the first one.
We heard again and again this week how he brought North Dakota into a modern age, I guess, and helped really transition that. And certainly a man who had connections at the national level, but came, you know, from, you know, a fairly, you know, I guess, grew up on a farm, you know.
Pretty modest background
and really worked hard and made those connections.
A modest background, but still in some way not quite a hard scrabble background.
No, that's correct. Yes,
but I can hear him speaking in my head right now, and the man had a way of kind of taking the heat out of the room.
Yes, he surely did, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
You know, I told this story in my column last week. When I was in the late 1960s, I was an anti-war activist at UND, and we took a petition to Bismarck. And he met us at the door of the Capitol and said, "Why don't you come on in out of the draft?" that was such a perfect expression. I mean, it caught the weather, it caught the political tone, and it made everybody feel, wow, you know. It took the heat out of the room.
That man had some wit.
Yes, he did. He was a tremendously funny guy. Could be, at least. Wasn't always, but could be. Yes.
Well, I just a minute or so left here. I saw an online poll in the Williston Herald today, and I don't usually put much credence in these, but it asked the question, do you feel safe in Williston? And the answer, 3-1, was no. I was kind of surprised by that.
Well, it says a lot, doesn't it?
But given the publicity about that, and the fact is that incidents have grown, but the Attorney General up until recently said, well, yeah, you've got more of a population, so by and large, the number of incidents is going to grow. You have to look at the per capita incidents, and he said that hasn't shown a lot of growth yet.
Well, I just wanted to throw that out there because that's something I'm going to keep an eye on. And just for you folks out there, the listeners, and, of course, our three news experts today, I'll be watching for Frack Daddy tomorrow at the Kentucky Derby. That's the two Montana oilmen who've named their horse Frack Daddy. He's number 18 on Saturday in the Kentucky Derby.
And, what are the odds?
The odds are, I don't think they're real good. He's number 18. Okay. So our thanks to Dave Thompson, of course. Every week we talk with our Prairie Public News Director, and then Mike Jacobs joins us from Grand Forks, the Grand Forks Herald publisher, and Tom Gerhart from Bismarck, also KXMB-TV News Director. Thanks you for joining us today for our Editor's Roundtable.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. Just email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or send us a message via the Main Street at Prairie Public Facebook page. And you can still call. The Main Street toll-free studio line is 888-755-6377.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 3rd. In May of 1904, Joseph Pulitzer, creator of the coveted Pulitzer Prize, wrote, "Our republic and its press will rise or fall together. An able, disinterested, public-spirited press, with trained intelligence to know the right and courage to do it, can preserve the public virtue. The power to mold the future of the republic will be in the hands of the journalists of future generations." Pulitzer, a journalist who fought governmental corruption, was one of the first to promote teaching journalism at a university level, believed journalism was a noble field. "Journalism," he said, "is one of unequaled importance for its influence upon the minds and morals of the people." He strove to attract people to the profession and help them remain moral and responsible in their work. Thus, the Pulitzer Prize was born. Pulitzer created the prize to award those who met expectations of moral and responsible journalism, but the standards for the awards were high. If no paper met these standards, awards were simply not given that year. The prize was given in 1938, however, and on this date, in 1938, the Bismarck Tribune announced the good news. The Tribune was given the 1938 Pulitzer for the most disinterested and meritorious public service rendered by any American newspaper during the year of 1937. This public service award was given specifically for the Tribune's self-help column titled Self-Help for the Dust Bowl, written by Kenneth W. Simons and researched by Gordon McGregor. Ultimately, it was McGregor who submitted the Tribune articles and editorials to the Pulitzer Prize Board. Begun in 1933 by Tribune editor George D. Mann, Self-Help for the Dust Bowl concentrated on aiding farmers in the depression-ravaged slope area. The column was based on the theory that if we are to expect help from others, we must show a willingness to help ourselves. The Tribune has resented the state of dependency into which circumstance has forced so much of this state. It has looked for a way out. It believes it has found in the practices of water conservation, range management, soil conservation, and better balanced agriculture, an agriculture more suited to this region than that which settlers brought with them from more humid districts. Simon's keystone was the need for irrigation development and for the diversification of the state's economy. Much of Simon's research came from McGregor, who was tireless in his work. He roamed up and down the western part of the state, probing, talking, and writing. The punishment he inflicted on himself was immense. To him, the vision was very, very real. One vision became reality when the State Water Commission was created in 1937. Both Simons and McGregor were described as men of vision. Their concentration was aimed primarily at building a stronger North Dakota during the time of economic depression. Yet as North Dakota continually develops and diversifies its economy today, it's easy to see that this vision continued well past those years and the year when Simons helped prove his newspaper and staff were worthy of the coveted Pulitzer Prize. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Tessa Sandstrom. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Enough time to tell you that Frack Daddy is 50-1 odds tomorrow in the Kentucky Derby. Incidentally, our thanks to Amy Dalrymple, who is the reporter from the Oil Patch for the Forum News Service, for bringing up the Frack Daddy story today. That's a pretty good one. And on Monday, even modern art can be old enough to have deteriorated or suffered damage. It's a challenge for preserving our cultural and artistic heritage, and that will be the topic of this month's Science Cafe. Joining us on Monday, Dr. Stuart Kroll, chair of the Department of Coating and Polymeric Materials at North Dakota State University. So find out how to take care of that stuff you like that's on the wall. Join us Monday for Main Street. In the meantime, have a great weekend.